amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie show. We're getting on for the end of August, but there's still plenty to talk about in stocks, in investing, and a little bit in cricket as well. I've got Steve D with me. We've had an interesting week. We were just looking at our portfolios and how they've done over the last 7 days or so, and I think probably fair to say both of us were slightly surprised, but busy times in and out of the market. Steve, how's your week been?
Busy. Yeah, very busy. The work taps in the construction industry, maybe temporarily or maybe not, have really turned on this week. We got a load of inquiries through when we've been like, you know, we've been doing this thing at work called the receipt game because there's been nothing to do, where whoever's been shopping brings in the receipt and we have to guess the name of produce. That's how little work we've had between the sort of six of us up there. And then this week's just been like a complete change around. There's been no time for the receipt game. We've been balls to the wall all week. And I've been meeting some pretty major clients, and I think they're probably one of the biggest. They might be the second biggest, trying to secure a few new sites for the company. So yeah, really, really busy in terms of stock market, Steve. I'm surprised to read I'm up 1% for the week. I thought it was worse than that, but I'm just looking at it now. It looks like we must have had a really bad end to last week.
Quite a bad end to last week.
Yeah, and then it's picked up all week till the 24th, which was that Wednesday, or was that Thursday, then dropped off a cliff, and then it's kind of been steady from then. But I finished 1% up, which is not too bad, Steve. Got my Bloomsbury dividend. I think you got that one as well. Still waiting for our Southern Copper dividend, Steve. I guess that one is in the post. How about you?
Yeah, got the Bloomsbury dividend. Strictly that's mine. De facto, it's for one of the godsons. So he owns Bloomsbury, Disney, and P&G is the other one that he owns. One of those is up quite a bit and the other two are not. So we'll work out what to do with that for him. I got a Bloomsbury dividend on the day it was paid, got a Citigroup dividend on the day it was paid, got a Realty Income dividend on the day it was paid. Trying to work out where the Southern Copper thing is. That appears to just, dividends appear to appear slightly randomly with Southern Copper. They appear, I guess, every so often. But with Southern Copper, I'm always interested to see how much it actually is as well that arrives. That fluctuates quite a bit. And since I'm now about, it's a month low, so I'm about 70-something% up on that, which means I probably won't buy any more shares, but I'll keep the same number of shares and just get a highly fluctuating dividend all over the place for the next, well, to infinity, maybe. I always get tempted to keep having a go at that and reinvesting there, but haven't quite managed to see it as the best thing available on the market just yet. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure I shouldn't be thinking that, just anchored to a very low price at the moment.
Yeah, I think potentially I'm the same. I'm up about 110% in it. And you just, the way the commodity market works, I hate to buy things at these kind of rates. Even though it looks cheap, it's always key about knowing where you are in the cycle to sort of assess how cheap that is. And I think Southern Copper at 40 is a thing that happens again in the future. And that's probably when I'll buy it again. Steve, have you ever watched the Bloomsbury price in your trading 2 app, just by the way? Because the last traded price does not work with Bloomsbury because the liquidity on it is so thin. Some days you log in and you'll be like, 391p, and you'll think, oh, well, I maybe should just top up a handful of shares on that. And you buy it and it goes through at 421 because you are the only liquidity in that share. It's pretty strange, but then it stays at like 391. So I basically had a whinge at trading 212 and I said, look, I understand that you know, the price is displaying at 391, and that's what you're saying is the last traded price. But then when I got a best execution report from them, which everybody is entitled to do, if you think your execution has been crap and you think they've given you a crap price, you can ask for a best execution report and they'll send you a snapshot of the book at the time of execution showing your trade and the ones around it. Steve, I asked for it and mine was bang on the money, so it's probably just a problem with their data feed.
Yeah, okay, so I haven't looked at the Bloomsbury feed for that, but I have owned and I suppose traded strictly other stocks that have thin liquidity, and I've seen something similar happen. I spent ages trying to buy some BP preferred, which is easier to buy than to say, but not by much. And I managed to buy some eventually. I was surprised it went through because initially it was struggling. I thought, well, I'll just leave this here on a market order and see what happens. And it did eventually go through. And then I started off immediately down about 16% because the spread on it was really wide because of low liquidity, actually. And low volume does that to the kind of spread. But yeah, I do own Bloomsbury. Well, my godson owns Bloomsbury. I'll tell him not to look. He's about 3 now, so I suspect he probably won't be looking. But Southern Copper, one that you can look at more often, I think. My portfolio's up, but not by as much as yours is this week. Some dividends come in, and that's pushed it a little bit higher too, as I mentioned. But even stripping those out, the kind of share price action has moved slightly higher, which is fine. There's still plenty of things that I'm happy to buy at these prices. I don't really want it to run away into the distance and make me think more carefully about what I want to reinvest stuff back into. But overall, a decent week. Out of the markets, though, much more interesting buying action and selling action. My parents have bought a house and sold one. Not quite at the same time, I suppose. Strictly one of them happened like an hour or so before the other one. But they have finally moved. They've been trying to move house since, well, close to since Alistair, my son, was born. So like about a year or so. And they had a chain set up and that fell through and it wasn't their fault. But they have finally managed to sell their place and buy a new one. They are now about between 15 and 20 minutes up the road from us. They're getting their stuff together and working out where everything's going to go, and working out that a lot of it's probably going to go in the bin because they've got furniture from one house that they're trying to put into a different one, and that doesn't always work terribly well. But they are finally in. That is the exciting-ish news from us this week. They're happily installed in their, I think happily installed in their new place, I hope happily anyway, where they will stay forever.
My parents have bought a house as well. That's very interesting.
They've finished too.
They've not finished. No, their house has not sold and still hasn't had a viewing, which is kind of strange because, like I say, it's one of the premier houses in the area. It might just be that it's too premier for that kind of area. It's very inner city suburb kind of area, and the areas around it are not so great. It's like a haven in the middle of a bad area. And the price that they wanted for it is a bit like, if I wanted that, I could just live in a nicer area. Do you know what I mean? And that's mm-hmm. kind of the problem that they've got with the house.
Surely not, than whatever part of Hull they're from.
Well, just the further you get out of Hull, the better it is. Do you know what I mean? they're still transport links in. They've ended up... they've both got decent pensions. Mum and Dad both worked all their life. And... my dad was quite a decent earner, but he sold down portfolios, cash, ISAs, and everything basically, and managed to scrub together the money to buy a much cheaper house. They're downsizing quite massively, mm-hmm. but they were looking, Stephen, as I sit here, they were looking at a house that was there, essentially. Ooh. And it was very close, and I was like, you know, you go around it going, oh, I think it's subsided a bit, this one. There's cracks in the wall and stuff. But they've actually bought a house which is, it's pretty much like, to be drive out of my house, go around the corner, and about 5 minutes down the road, it's there. Which, you know, you would think, well, that's a bit close, maybe. But
I was going to say, is that far enough away? Yeah.
Well, they're going to be premier childcare, aren't they? From this kind of, they basically just signed themselves up, haven't they, for being essentially the child drop-off centre?
Probably yes. Mine have like explicitly signed themselves up for that. They're very keen to be the childcare unit because, in case anyone couldn't tell from my horrendous personality, I'm in fact an only child, and that means that any future grandchildren they have are likely to be pretty adjacent to where Alistair is, at least in the short term. So they've put themselves nearby and they've decided they want to move closer to their grandson, which unfortunately means they have to move closer to me as well. But Steve, you're not an only child. Explains why you're much more likeable than I am. Have any of your parents got other grandkids? Or
they do, yeah. They've got two and they run off the feet with them. But at the end of the day, what's one more? they're both retired. They've got nothing better to do. My dad does like a game of golf, but you know, they'll have to plan that around looking after my children. Thank you.
They're not moving too far away from those ones, though.
No, they actually, they're moving. They were way away from us. They're 20 minutes away from us now. They're actually moving in the middle of us, where we both live. So, yes, it's handy for them as well. And we also think it's handy because there's where they've moved to. It's basically a village just around the corner, and it's got like, you know, your pub, a butcher's, a bakery, things like that. It's more. Retirement sort of a place to live. Nice gardens, nice people, nice village, local amenities. They don't have to drive. Eventually, they probably won't drive an awful lot. My mum and dad are old. They had me late into their 30s and early 40s, so they're well retired now. So yeah, I think it'd be great for them. I just hope that they can get the house sold because it's a big cash outlay. They're not obviously going to get a mortgage because they're too old. And it just leaves you a bit out of pocket for a little while.
Yeah, so they're hoping for a big upswing then in the property market, which so far isn't...
They're just hoping to sell it. I don't think there's any... They're not after any great money for it. They just want what the going rate is and for somebody to come along and enjoy it. Like, I mean, they've lived in it for 30-odd years, Steve, so they've 35 years. So it's a big family home, and for two people, the dog's dead as well now, so there's not even the dog in it. So it's just the two of them. So it's a four bed. It's huge. They don't use three of the rooms. It's just silly for two people to be rattling around.
Fair enough. My dad does not, by the way, like a game of golf. What he likes, at least to watch anyway, is a game of cricket, which means that it's getting to the business end of the cricket season, Steve. The finals of the 100 are this week. I'm going to get your predictions about who's going to win them for the men's and the women's. And if it helps, I will tell you which teams are still left in.
That will help.
Well, it might help. So on the women's team, you have three teams that are still left in no particular order. You have the Southern Brave, the London Spirit, and the Welsh Fire. None of them particularly local to you here, Steve. Who do you think might win out of these?
No idea. I'll go with the Southern Brave. Is that the one Sophie Eccleston plays for, or did play for?
No, they're out. She's one of the northern ones, I think, Sophie Eccleston. Southern Brave, they would have been my choice, so I'll have London Spirit then. We've selected between us the two teams that are playing today in the Eliminator. So Welsh Fire is straight through to the final. The Brave, which is Smitty Mandana, Maya Bouchier, that crowd, against the Spirit, which is... Hang on, that can't be right. I thought Spirit were out. I thought they'd been dropped from this. I'm picking Welsh Fire. I thought I saw someone drop a catch with the scores level to put Spirit out, which was... hard moment that to listen to, but okay, we'll take the Fire and the Brave between us against whoever. Fire in the final, I'm pretty sure of that. Yeah, you can have the Brave. I would have picked those as well, but they seem pretty good. The men's competition, I'm pretty sure I can remember who's in this. Oval Invincibles, Manchester Originals, and I think the Southern Brave again.
Couldn't even tell you who plays for any of those people.
Oval is Surrey in disguise, basically. Okay. So Manchester is sort of Lancashire-ish in disguise. And the Southern Brave is Sussex-ish in disguise, is the best way to put it.
Being a Yorkshire boy, I can't possibly go for Lancashire in disguise. Mm. That would be illegal. So I'll stick with the Southern Brave. I'll go with Sussex in disguise.
Mm, that has made my life difficult because I, from where I'm from, can't possibly pick Oval. You got the Brave for both of them. I'll have Originals then. I think that might be the Joss Butler team. I could be wrong about that, but I think that might be them. He's a good player. Brave down there have... Who do they have? I'm not sure they have a massive all-star cast. I saw them play last year, but they're a good team. They've won this competition before. The others haven't. I refuse to pick Oval, who are the team already in the final. So we've got the Eliminator teams between us. You have Southern Brave. I'm pretty sure it's Manchester, but whichever one is not them. Join us next week when we will discover that it's been won by the Oval and a team that I have forgotten in the women's competition. But okay, enough cricket. Should we talk about stocks and stuff, Steve?
Let's do it.
Okie dokes. So here's the big news this week. There's an IPO coming, and it's an IPO that everybody, I think, wants to be interested in, has been looking forward to for some time. Certainly true of me. The I think it's the F1 form has been submitted for all the details that people will need to know about this. Steve, are you looking forward to Kellogg spinning off their cereal arm?
Very much so. We've talked about this one, Steve. We've been very excited about this one for weeks, so I cannot wait for it to happen.
Believe it or not, there is actually one happening at Kellogg IPO, spin-off, I guess, or IPO of Kellanova, the big name, is happening sometime in Q4. Before that, though, Arm Holding from the UK, a UK tech company, and what a UK tech company is going to IPO, but not in the UK. They have filed for their IPO. There's no specified date yet, but they are talking about early September, so that may not be very far away. They said as soon as is possible, basically. It's being IPO'd by SoftBank. There are some anchor investors, more on what they are in a moment, which include Alphabet, Apple, Intel, Nvidia, Microsoft, Samsung, and TSMC. So pretty much all the big names from the semiconductor industry and Intel are anchor investors for this. The details came out from the Arm Holdings' recent set of accounts, and they were quite interesting. They've got an earnings CAGR over the last 3 years of about 16%, a gross margin of around 95%, massive R&D costs, revenue around 2.6 billion, and net income at about 524. I will stop there because, Steve, you sent me an interested, highlighted version of this income statement. What was catching your eye?
That pretty much it's in decline from the year previous. So looking at revenue, that is down from 2.7 billion to 2.679, net income down from 549 million to 524. Yes, there is some more R&D spending in there and things like that, but that's not what I was expecting from a company looking to IPO at about 25 times sales, Steve, is the guesstimate price at the moment. Would you want to be paying 25 times sales for a company that's a cyclical?
No, at least not one that's that cyclical. I mean, it feels like this is... So SoftBank are the company kind of spinning this out, or spinning out at least part of their investment in this in the form of an IPO. And I'm kind of trying to work out what to make of the timing of this, right? So it's not peak IPO. Peak IPO was 2021. And in fairness, then we may well never see peak IPO again for, well, decades, potentially. That level of kind of enthusiasm for anything new on the market. And the valuation they could have got for it then must have been through the roof. It feels like it's an interesting time to be letting this out as SoftBank, because there's clearly a lot of positive sentiment around AI at the moment. And Arm is a well-positioned chip company. They're an architecture company along with kind of Intel. More on it in a moment. But it also feels like it's a time where valuations aren't super high in the markets at the moment. And I was trying to work out exactly whether they've got a target of 60 to 70 billion in mind for this. That feels kind of expensive. I mean, if you think they come in at the 60 end, that's about 114 times PE ratio, and 70 billion is 133 times PE ratio. It's a lot. They've got some good backers there. But what do you think? Would you be interested in this at either of those numbers?
No, not really. And I suggest that we'll probably be able to get it a bit cheaper a few quarters down the line. Mm. One of the things I spotted, Steve, that was really, have you been through that? I don't know if you've had a good look through the S1 yet, but the risk section of that S1, there's a lot of pages, Steve. There's a lot of risks that they're highlighting there. And one of them was that in the past, we have received late payments from Arm China and have had to expend company resources to obtain payments from Arm China. This is your own company in China that aren't paying you. And they tried to make out like that was all sort of finished. But if you look at China revenue and accounts receivable, 24% of revenue came from Arm China, but 40% of accounts receivable are still attributed to China. So that just means that Arm still aren't getting paid for all the products that they're selling in China. So that is quite worrying to me, Steve. I think there's something weird going on with this company, and I'm not sure I really like it.
Getting money out of China isn't in its or difficulties getting money out of China isn't in itself new. Ask supporters of Reading Football Club for that one. They're getting into all sorts of problems and being fined and having points docked and transfer embargoes, mostly because their chairman is struggling to get money out of China, from what I understand of it. But, I mean, it's 24% of their revenues then. And if you're looking for a punchy valuation, you would want the idea that there's not going to be an issue with 24% of your revenue coming down. I haven't read the risk section yet. I don't mind the fact that it's long kind of per se. It looks like the kind of company I'd sort of like to own. It looks like one step removed from ASML to me. So the way I think of the semiconductor industry is the further back along the kind of chain you go, the more it kind of narrows down into the number of participants here. So you think ASML at kind of one end of it, they're kind of by themselves. People talk about them as a monopoly, especially in EUV and whatever it is that comes after EUV, and maybe rightly so. And then you kind of move one step further on from that, and you get to architecture, which is realistically ARM or Intel, depending on what kind of chip you're trying to manufacture and what you want this chip for. And then you move further up, and there's various people doing various bits of process, and there's further on from that, there's people doing different levels of design, and so on and so forth. So they're quite nicely positioned, and they are winning in the architecture kind of race. My loose understanding of this, and I'm not an expert on semiconductor equipment or design, is that broadly speaking, there's two types of architecture. There's ARM stuff, and there's Intel's x86 stuff. And historically, the way it's worked is ARM has been smaller, lighter, a little bit faster, but a lot less capacity. And that's ideal for stuff like phones, which are smaller and lighter. Intel's x86 stuff is bigger, stronger, heavier, slower, from what I can see of it. And that's ideal for big, heavy processing things like PCs. And then there's the kind of middle, which is everyone would like an x86 powered thing, the size and weight of an ARM thing. And they've been working their way towards the middle on that, and ARM is kicking Intel up and down the board at the moment, from what I can see of it. And so you have things like Apple, which uses ARM architecture in its laptops. Anything using Windows, I think, uses x86. But gradually, ARM has been kind of winning and winning and winning there, and it's now in a very strong position. So, good company, but big, big target for this, and with earnings not really there to match at the moment.
Well, I do wonder if this is just part of that sort of slowdown in the smartphone market is attributed to some of this. Because I noticed that Snapdragon was one of their biggest customers. Snapdragon obviously do the vast majority of the decent CPUs in the Android level phone. So I wondered if that was something to do with the slowdown in revenue this year. Perhaps it is just semi-cyclical. I think SoftBank are spinning a bit of a yarn on this one about it being an AI-focused company. It's not really an AI-focused company. It's an AI enabler of sorts, isn't it, in that people can use and license this software to make AI chips, design AI chips. But it's not really an AI story that I see. It's an AI story in the same way that like VAC Group is an AI story, in that, you know, without a vacuum systems, you would find it quite difficult to make an AI chip. But they're not, no, you wouldn't say VAT is an AI leader in the AI space like SoftBank are trying to tell you. But Steve, I mean, it was only a few months ago that Nvidia wanted to pay big money to acquire this company. And they obviously could see something of value there, maybe something that we're missing. And they were prepared to pay a decent amount of money for this company. In fact, the deal only got stopped at the regulators, didn't it? So it got accepted. But so there must be something there. Jensen Huang is a decent capital allocator. We will find out he's quite a poor one soon, I would imagine. But he's been pretty shrewd about his the way he's acquired for Nvidia and the way he's ran Nvidia. So maybe there's something, Steve, that's just, maybe it's one for the too hard, pal. Maybe there's something we just don't see in it.
Maybe. I mean, I think at this price goes in the too hard pile from my perspective. So there's a level at which I think I could see, clearly there's a level at which I could see this stock and say, yeah, look, there's lots I don't understand here, but it's clearly too cheap. Think sort of Netflix a while back, or Meta a while back, or all that kind of thing, where you think, okay, maybe I don't get the full ins and outs of this, but it's worth more than that. It's not that price, or they're not talking about that price anyway. We'll see where it comes out. But there's what it's worth to Nvidia, of course, and what it's worth to you and me. I mean, one thing it's worth to Nvidia is a big antitrust bonus on this. If you can acquire the architecture outfit, then you suddenly cut all your competitors off at the knee, which is why it got stopped, right? But that's worth a lot. You'd pay a lot to do that. You'd pay a lot to stop it happening as well if you were a different competitor. But I guess there's what it's worth to them, and I can definitely see the attraction of having that kind of in-house. It's a little bit like the Activision Blizzard Microsoft thing, I suppose. But I'm expecting to leave this behind. When I looked at the market cap for this and just looked at some other companies with the same market cap, it didn't look massively crazy to me. I mean, maybe there's definitely different unit economics with these things, and their margin is only around sort of 25% or so, and their sales just seem to be lower. But I mean, 60 odd billion puts them in the same territory, or between 60 and 70 billion, let's say, puts them in the same territory as stuff like Mercado Libre, PayPal, Waste Management, Moody's, Colgate Palmolive. Those are big companies. Those are big, important companies. But it's not kind of crazy to think of Arm like them, is it?
I don't know. I think it's still too early for us to really give you a conclusive answer there, isn't it? I mean, if we're talking about a company that's at the beginning of its growth cycle, then you're not gonna worry about that particularly. But it just worries me that so early on. I mean, we'll see it with companies we talk about today who are going through periods of pressure on their sales, but they're still growing, Steve. And it might be single digits or low double digits, but they're still growing, and that's tricky to me to look at something like Arm, which, you know, you think is, they're trying to spin it off as having a free run. I know there is a competitor, Risk-V. I think it's pronounced Risk-5 off the top of my head.
Oh.
But yeah, that's an open source competitor that's been going for about 8 years. And that is a competitor to Arm. And again, I don't know the technicalities of it, but they brush that off as, don't worry about it kind of thing. But I mean, of course, they're going to say that they're going through IPO and they want a pretty high valuation. So it's just not for me, Steve. I would be buying a third of this valuation. I could take a risk at 10 times sales if I believe there was growth there. But I think it's one of those IPOs where I'm going to be like, okay, show me. I think it's, you know, we're talking about stock market being a voting machine versus a weighing machine, you know, a sentiment indicator. And I guess this IPO, the whole thing depends on the sentiment towards to AI and whether that's still going. And if that is still going, it'll have a decent valuation. If it doesn't, it will crash quickly.
Yeah, it feels like to me there'll be better opportunities to buy this than at its IPO when I think there will be a good amount of excitement about this. It's been sort of fairly hotly anticipated. I mean, hotly enough for us to be talking about it anyway. Last kind of question on this from me. Steve, as a London Stock Exchange Group shareholder, which I think you still are you disappointed to see this listing on the NASDAQ rather than the FTSE something?
Not really. I was talking to John Stepek about this on Twitter. He does Merrin Talks Money podcast. He's usually the guest at the beginning. We had a brief chat, and both of us agreed that this was he just wouldn't have got the money for London Stock Exchange. There's just no reason for it to list on the London Stock Exchange again, because it just wouldn't have got anywhere near the valuation. I mean, they're talking about 10 billion hitting the balance sheet from this IPO, Steve. You just wouldn't have got that from the UK. I would have been surprised if it even listed with a 10 billion valuation.
Wow. Yeah, so looking for between 60 and 70 would put it at around number 10, 11 in the FTSE 100. Down at the 10 billion mark would be, that would be putting it around the same level as actually some stocks we quite like, by the way, like Halma and Spirax Sarco. But I guess I'm slightly disappointed, but realistically I don't see it was ever on the cards, right? I mean, it's SoftBank's decision. It's not the decision that has anything to do with the UK. I'm not actually sure it has anything to do with Arm either, for what that's worth. They kind of go where they're told in this story, right? I mean, someone was asking Arm to either dual list or list on the UK exchanges, but not really clear it's up to them. Thought they were basically owned and decision made for them.
The best we can hope for is an ADR if we want it over here. I don't think I can't. Well, they may dual list in the end. They may eventually move some part of it over here to dual list, but I can't see it.
No, nor can I think. Ticker symbol NASDAQ ARM, apparently, is what it's going to be. Makes a lot of sense. Okay, Steve, that's exciting UK-ish news out the way for the moment. What have you been looking at from the earnings world?
So Autodesk was the one I've been looking at first up, Steve. This is one I've bought into fairly recently. I was put off over COVID because its valuation got quite obscene. It's come down quite a lot since then. And now I think it's trading in a sort of range where it's a little bit more palatable. But I'll go through it anyway. It was the second quarter 2024, Steve, because they're time travelers. And I'll see what you think. So total revenue increased 9% to 1.345 billion. GAAP operating margin was 19%. That's actually down 1%. Non-GAAP op profit was flat at 36%. That's margin, obviously. And GAAP diluted EPS was $1.03. Non-GAAP diluted EPS was $1.91. That's just backing out all the one-time crap that we normally see in a non-GAAP metric. Cash flow from operating activities, Steve, was $135 million. Free cash flow was about $128 million. So Debbie Clifford said, our sustained momentum in the second quarter and early expansion of some enterprise business agreements expected to renew later in the year and reduce the likelihood of our more cautious forecast scenarios. And given that, we are raising the lower end of our guidance ranges. So she's the CFO. So a little, quite nice beat and raise from Autodesk. She actually beat on revenue, on the bottom line, and then raised guidance, which is the old triple beat, Steve. Some additional stuff I've pulled out of the presentation. Total billings actually decreased 8% to $1.1 billion, and that was obviously because of what Debbie just told you there, that they've pulled forward some agreements. Recurring revenue represented about 98% of the total revenue. Subscription plan revenue was about $1.27 billion, which was an increase of 9% as reported, but it's actually 13% on a constant currency basis. On a sequential basis, subscription plan revenue increased 6% as reported and 7% on a constant currency basis. Net revenue retention rate remained within their guidance range of 100 to 110%. They don't tell you which, they just told you it was in it. That's on a constant currency basis, though. And GAAP op income was $262 million compared to $242 million in the second quarter last year. GAAP op margin, obviously 19, down 1. I think I've already said that. I don't know why I've got that in twice. Segment, so Autodesk Engineering and Construction was $627 million versus $564 last year. That's up 11. AutoCAD, $354 versus $344. That's up 6%. Manufacturing arm was $256 million versus $242 million, up 6%. And media and entertainment and other was $98 million versus $87 million, up 13%. And just by geography, Steve, US, $485 million versus $424. That's up 13%. Other Americas, $104 versus $91, up 14%. EMEA, which is Europe, Middle East, and Africa, $506 million versus $473 million. Look at us, Steve. We're the biggest customer now. Full year, 12, although that is a massive part of the world, yeah, was up 7%. Asia Pacific was $250 million versus $249 million. They called that flat, Steve, but that's a bigger number. And we know maths. So banging some loose numbers into a reverse DCF, Steve, has told me that Autodesk does have to slightly reaccelerate its top line from 8% to 9% to achieve a 10% return. But it probably doesn't have to go as far as you'd think. And it might surprise you how far this one has come down in terms of its valuation. I think this one has some headwinds, but it's probably okay for me in the long run here. Price to free cash flow, Steve, trailing 12 months is under 20 at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And shares outstanding is declining, not increasing. So just how quickly this business adapts to the change is a very interesting thing to watch, Steve. They're always trying to keep ahead of competition and keep up with the current trends. One of the things I could point to is how quickly they acquired Revit and how quickly they led construction industry's movement into BIM, which is building information modeling, which secured their moat in construction in a lot of territories, at least for now. So 8.5% up on the week, Steve. For full disclosure again, I do own this one. Do you use much AutoCAD in your field, Steve?
I do not use much AutoCAD in my field. I do not use much auto anything in my field, actually. But I was looking quite again at this, and this is a really interesting looking company by the numbers, as far as I can tell here. So it's a really interesting company where if you look at the backwards looking numbers, and sometimes it's good to look at the backwards looking numbers, and I'm not saying you should completely ignore them, it looks really expensive. If you look at the forwards looking ones, or the ones that have not necessarily adjustments, but are not just an EPS number, it doesn't look that expensive at all. As you pointed out, I've got 19.84 written down for its price to free cash flow here. So a fraction under 20, as you were saying, which is not super, super cheap, but it's looking at growing at around similar rate as far as I can see here. The other thing that really kind of catches my eye in this kind of business is you said $135 million in operating cash flows, $128 million in free cash flows. In other words, sod all CapEx. More for, you said there's a reducing share count. You mentioned acquisitions. More for this kind of thing. They're not going to spend huge amounts of it replacing or repairing or whatever machinery or even anything else for that matter. So huge, huge, huge free cash margin from operating cash flow, low capex. This looks like, with the share price where it is, I think it's kind of looks more expensive than it is, I reckon.
Yeah, I think that's what throws everybody. I think on a screener, this just isn't going to come up. If you're looking for something, you know, a software company with a PE of, say, 25 growing at 10%, you're going to miss out on this one because essentially it's, you know, its forward-looking metrics look a lot tidier than its backwards. So I think it's a bit of a hidden gem for me, Steve. Hidden in plain sight, maybe. We've used that phrase before today, but it's a big company. I would assume most people know the products, even if they don't work in sectors, and they know how important AutoCAD is to architects and engineers and draftsmen. Well, all over the world, essentially. So not to mention they own products in game design and 3D design and modeling software and business information modeling. Revit is used in colleges and universities up and down the country as well. They've got that Adobe Microsoft way of basically getting themselves into colleges and universities, getting kids trained on Revit and Autodesk, AutoCAD, and then when they leave university, they kind of carry on using them. And it's a smart system, it's a proven system. And obviously then you've got this recurring revenue, Steve, where you've got a semi guaranteed level of revenue coming along, and they just need to attract a few customers every quarter, and that just continues growing for you.
Yeah, and that's a really nice kind of model for getting people in and trained, and then switching costs become difficult. I was looking at this, the kind of markets that this bunch serves. It says architects and engineers and construction and so on. You're one of those things, right? I'm never quite sure exactly which of those things you are. I'm pretty sure it's not an architect, but you do a lot of drawing for someone who's not an architect.
Yeah, so it's actually a component part of our software. So one of the ways that they do operate is by selling aspects of the product out to other products. So the engineering software we use is called Premier, and they basically have all of the drafting software from AutoCAD in it, but then they build their own engineering software on top of it. So I use AutoCAD every minute of every day I'm at work usually.
Yeah, there's a lot kind of getting in the way of the just kind of, there's a lot of gap stuff getting in the way looking back over the last year, isn't there? That op margin goes from sort of 19%, I think you said, if you think of the gap op margin, up to about 36%, so roughly doubles, which gets you much more looking like something software-y, I suppose. You kind of think software margin's sort of more in the 30s than in the, well, certainly than in the teens, but than in the 20s. So that's a really interesting kind of thing to have a look at here. You said it's the one-off stuff, right?
Yeah, I think there's an element of seasonality to the licensing deal. So I think some people are on monthly subscriptions, and the people who are licensing the arms of it are out on yearly subscription or annual subscription. So I think the operating margin is quite lumpy because, like I said, there's 100 odd million of free cash flow, but actually they'll do about 2 billion in the year. And it just shows you how lumpy some of those deals are. Just the sort of, it's recurring revenue, but it's slightly more irregular than a monthly subscription.
Yeah, and market cap around 45 billion. It's been quite up and down over the last, close to a year or so. It's been below sort of 200. It's about 10-15% higher than it once was. You must be doing all right with this stock, I would guess. I mean, it's close to its highs for the year.
My average on this, Steve, is about $200. I bought in one large tranche when it went to that, and then I just bought just five share amounts since then. So my average is probably just over $200.
So give or take the FX, you're up around just under 10% then.
I think it's about 7.5%,
yeah,
something like
about
that.
7.5%. Cool. Keeping it rather than buying it? Let them just buy back shares and let them grow your stake like that for you?
No, I'd continue to buy it at this kind of range. I don't think it's massively out of whack here. And I it's a company that I think reaccelerates as the construction industry picks back up again.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So I think of these software things as, okay, they have kind of cyclical end markets, but I don't think of them as super cyclical themselves, I guess, when that thing comes around here. There's demand for this does step up and down then with the the kind of construction end market. I mean, that's kind of subscriptions kind of stay fixed, right? Or
yeah, but you got to think there's hiring and firing mm-hmm. tax on extra subscriptions. When obviously construction is good, a lot of companies step up, start up, and start building, and most of them will need a subscription for Revit or something like that, so that they can have a look at the ActX plans and change them usually to make them work.
Always interesting watching these kind of beat and raise things. It feels like at the moment things are very much going in different directions across the market at the moment. Things that are missing, things are going either up, down, up sharply or down sharply. It's not one of those times where everything is pushing higher on earnings or everything is kind of getting hammered by slight disappointments and that sort of thing. So this is really sorting out the kind of, at least in the short term, the good from the less good, which is, I guess, something I thought was fairly overdue in the market a little bit. We still got a fair bit of the unprofitables and fairly hopeless looking businesses doing quite well. Car companies in particular stick out to me here, and things that I was looking at Rivian's cash burn. It's a lot. That might be a nuisance as an Amazon shareholder. But should we talk about another positive looking tech thing, Steve? Or you got anything else on this?
No, let's do it.
Okay, a company called Nvidia also reported earnings this week. Their shares initially jumped out to about 9% higher than they were before, and 9% is quite a lot when you're a $1.1 trillion company. The market said, okay, have another $100 billion of market cap here. Since then, though, this was around Wednesday, it's mostly given it back over the last kind of couple of days, and it's finished 3% this week higher, which means that it's not wildly more expensive than it was at the beginning of the week if you were buying shares then, which I imagine some people were kind of into earnings. The S&P for context here is about flat on the week. It's plus about 0.5 or something, so about plus 3 for Nvidia and plus 5 for the S&P, so it finishes ahead. But these were some mighty impressive earnings according to kind of quite a lot of people here, Steve. So revenue came in at 13.51 billion, which was up just 101%. Operating income came in at 6.8 billion, which was up 413%. Earnings per share up to $2.70, which was up 429%. If that's not growth, it's hard to say what is. The kind of highlight was their data center revenue, which grew by 171% to around 10.8 billion, I think I've got written here, which that one might not be quite right, but it is the vast majority of that revenue coming from the data center division here. So with an extra 249 in EPS, these were all significant beats, by the way. They came in way higher than Wall Street was expecting, even with some fairly kind of punchy guidance looking forward. And they're guiding for 16 billion in revenues next quarter. So that would be year over year. I think their Q3 of last year was actually lower than their Q2 of last year, revenue-wise. So that would be 170% growth year over year, although not quarter over quarter. So from 13.5 to 16 billion, 10.32 is what I've got written down here for data center revenue. That was a record. Steve, what do you make of this? I've got some thoughts here in a little bit, but impressed?
Well, it's hard not to be, isn't it? I mean, when that guide came out last quarter, everybody was like, oh, that's brave, because Nvidia are kind of conservative with the guidance. They've always been conservative because they like to beat. And when this guide came out, everybody was like, whoa, hey, up a second. That's brave. You're predicting, you know, that much. And then they beat it, Steve, by about $2.5 billion, just $2.5 billion. Absolutely smashed the guide. And I had that dawning realization when I was reading the results, and I tweeted out at the time. I said, I can't believe Nvidia sandbagged us. Which is a strange term to use when somebody's predicting just that randomly 100% growth. But they must have seen it, Steve. It must have already been started. Those orders must have been flooded in and look like they're continuing to flood in. I'm just looking at Q1 full year 24, 4.28 billion in data center revenue, Steve. And that was a handy jump from the quarter before, which was 3.616. 10.323, Steve, is the jump. It's two and a bit times that. So it is incredible what Nvidia have done here, and then to tell you that there's more to come as well. If you thought AI was just hype, there are companies benefiting from that hype, and Nvidia is definitely one of them. But the issue you've got, Steve, is does it continue? Are we looking at a one-off or two-off or three-quarter kind of thing here while the data centers kind of gear up and then it just goes back to a churn and slow burn kind of thing? I also worry from the opposite side of thinking AI might be a bit of a passing fad. The companies that I invest in, the Googles, the Amazons, who are probably the people buying these chips, are they kind of overcompensating for the hype that might never actually materialize? It's a tricky old time to be on either side of this equation, I think. And I think it's one of those where I'm happy to just sit and watch Google and Amazon and hope that their leadership sees, you know, or knows more about this than I do. But I'm not entirely sure that I would be out rushing to buy Nvidia right now, Steve. But as we discussed, or as you mentioned, actually, a few days ago, the Nvidia valuation today is no worse than it was before these earnings, even after the jump up when people were saying like, oh, well, you know, this valuation's getting insane, blah, 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 blah. Well, it was no more insane with that 10 or 12% raise than it was the day before the earnings, because they beat earnings so handily. The valuation was essentially static. But I'm still not buying it, Steve. I should have bought this at 120. I think I told you at 120 that it was getting quite interesting to me, and I didn't pull the trigger, and that's looking like another one of those to stick in the mistake pile.
Yeah. So let's start where you left off there. I was trying to work out what I thought of this gain, and I was looking at a company the size of Nvidia in terms of market cap getting another 10% and thinking about what that meant, right? It's like another 100 billion near enough getting kind of added on here. And I thought, that's a lot to be paying more for a business overnight. Having said, you know, okay, yeah, sure, have another 100 billion. The asking price just went up by on this. And I thought to myself, well, actually, it's kind of not correct. They made an awful lot more overnight. Their earnings has just gone up by an enormous amount in terms of what they're kind of reporting into as operating income and net income, in fact. So look at it at the kind of share price level then, if you like. They've got an extra $2.49 from where they were in Q2 last year. That's the kind of difference between the $2.70 they were reporting and the cents that they were reporting a year ago. And for that extra $2.49, the market's offering them an extra $40 in share price. That doesn't seem sort of mad to me. That's 16 times the increase. Okay, would you pay 16 times earnings for this? Yeah, probably. That's not crazy here. It's the rest of it that's kind of the sort of optimistic bit, you might think here. But then if you suppose then for the moment that Nvidia is going to, they're guiding to keep growing here, right? They're not talking about sticking around at 13 something billion. They're talking about pushing themselves up to 16 billion and I wouldn't be at all surprised to hear that they're going to forecast growth for Q4, the one after that, and then further on into next year as this stuff carries on. When I start thinking, okay, let's say we stick at $2.70 for the time being for earnings, that still takes us to about a 46 PE. 46 PE is, well, it's higher than average, especially at the moment. With interest rates going up, PEs are coming down, valuations are coming in. 46 is very high. It's a lot lower than the 239 that they currently look like. If you just read this backwards, and if you're the kind of person who likes typing wrong numbers into spreadsheets and then tweeting about them, and you say, oh, it's trading at a 239 PE, this is all hype and noise, and there's a lot built into this, and this must be very expensive, you would be right, but you would be, I suppose, missing a very important point, which is that they are growing their earnings per share at 429% a year. When you're growing at 429% and you have a 239 PE ratio, your PEG is actually about a half. It's just under half. You are growing faster than your thing. And what would you pay for something that's going to keep growing like that? Would you pay 239 times earning for something that's going to grow at 400% into the future? Yeah, I mean, you ought to. Will it grow into the future, though, is your question. I saw some red flags, not from the earnings, but from stuff around it that caught my attention here. So a guy called Angelo Zeno, who is an analyst for, I think, Yahoo Finance. So not B of A, but someone is paying him for this stuff, said that he thinks that Nvidia will be the most important company to civilization over the next 5 to 10 years. Noted enthusiast for ripping people off, Chamat. Said, how, this is not a quote, but with all that capex, how can it not basically generate some new breakthrough into some area of technology? And Cathie Wood sold the stuff not terribly long ago, or was selling shares in it not that long ago. all of these things lead me to think that there's a lot priced into this. There's a lot of high expectation priced into here, and a lot of it justifiably so, right? They've come through quite strongly in the last quarter. I wonder about how long this will run. The next 5 to 10 years, the most important company to civilization. Big claim. I personally thought that might have been Kellogg's, but if that's what Angelo Zeno says, I kind of struggle to see the upside at these prices, I think is where I come out, Steve. I'm not saying these are crazy, but if I had a base case, it would be probably closer to this than I'd like it to be, which leaves not much room for upside here.
Yeah, it's a brave claim, that, isn't it? Not that we've ever really thought much about anything Chamath says. In fact, he was the focus of two quite important games, Steve, that we should probably revisit again, because I suggest that I think some of the ones he invested in have already gone bust. But I do remember him putting up that graph trying to point out that
he is in the arena, though, to be clear. He's in the arena. Don't know if you saw that on Twitter this week, but that's what he's saying about things.
Right, okay. Well, I do remember him putting up that social capital letter where he compared himself to Warren Buffett and said he was the new age Warren Buffett during the height of the SPAC craze. So, yeah, I think very little of him. And that's being very polite. And I think very little about buying Nvidia here, Steve, as well. I put a meme on the Trading 212 subreddit of basically a cheerleader shaking her body and the a man in the crowd trying desperately not to look, and titled it Nvidia.
Is it Jimmy Fallon, the man in the crowd?
Yeah, I think it's Jimmy Fallon, yeah. And yeah, and that's how I feel about Nvidia. I think it is basically trying to shake its body at me, and I'm going to just try and keep ignoring it.
They're shaking their body more than you, Steve. They've got something for the dividend investors too. There's a $25 billion buyback coming, I think. By the way, if there's anything I don't like in this, it's in this report, it's that.
Yeah.
I'm not a massive fan of buying back your shares at this price if you're Nvidia. They know better than me. They may well know that their shares are undervalued here. And look, it's hard to complain about them when they're putting up results like this. But buying back now... really? Maybe. But I'm not a fan of that idea. I'd rather they dividend it out.
Yeah, so look, I had the same thought as you on this one. I was like, why are they doing this? And then I sat and thought for a while. So what else can they do? They're that big now, they're not going to be allowed to get any kind of acquisition through. That's been proven.
Yeah,
with
tried.
The ARM. Yeah, that's been proven with the ARM Holdings acquisition. Dividending it out, that's probably not really in their kind of mantra. So here they are. They're going to buy back their own shares. I think this will probably turn out to be one of those really poor allocations of capital. I saw DRG Invests on Twitter. He's quite a good follower, to be fair. He's a value investor with his head screwed on. Said they'd be better off buying bonds. They'd probably get a better return at the moment buying US Treasuries. And I thought about that for a while, and I thought that's totally not something Nvidia would do. I actually think he's probably right there.
Yeah, so I look at it, they're going to take the, when I was looking, it's around to just under 2.5%, 2.25% or so of their market cap they'll take out like that. So if you think there's that boost to earnings coming, yeah, you could get a better return on a 10-year treasury at the moment by whacking it into there and just collecting on that. Nvidia doesn't strike me as the moment for Nvidia to be doing buybacks, either in terms of the numbers or in terms of where they are in the cycle. They're sticking their foot to the boards and doing stuff, right?
Yeah, but I just don't know what else they can do. Do you know what I mean? I don't know what else they can pick up, what else they can try, what else they could do with their money. It's not like they're not, you know, it's not like they've gone, right, we're going to shut down the R&D department and we're going to focus on just just going to focus on buybacks and dividends. I mean, they spent a few billion on R&D just in the last quarter. I think it was 2 billion. So annualizing that at 8, that's not a small amount of money. I suppose they could pump some more money into that if they feel like there's something they're going to generate out of it. But I just don't know, Steve. To be honest with you, with Nvidia, one of the things that their R&D that they have done quite badly is R&D. other people tend to find uses for their products and sort of shock NVIDIA with it, which is the story of Google finding out that NVIDIA's chips were better at, for AI than you know, than a normal chip was, or a chip, an Intel chip, an x86 chip. So I don't know, Steve. I'm against it, but only against it because the valuation feels a bit stinky at the moment. But maybe it's their money. They can do what they bloody want with it.
Yes, with $25 billion, they could, at a slight premium, acquire a company like Splunk, which is currently at just under 20 or so. Do you think this would be a good idea for them, Steve?
Well, Splunk have had a good week, Steve. We may as well go over it, seeing as though we're here. So I don't think we've ever covered this one on the show. I think it's new to us. I think we may have mentioned it in passing to each other, Steve, as a company, but it's a leading company in the cybersecurity industry. I think it's the third largest, although in terms of revenue, but I'm not 100% on that one. It's one of the ones that goes under the radar a little bit because it's just a little bit more slow growing than its peers, and it's been around a little bit longer than its peers. But I was having a look on the website to try and give you a concise idea of what they do, Steve, and they say that their cloud platform provides security and observability to some of the biggest companies in the S&P. So now that we've nailed down exactly what this company does, let's go to have a look at their Q2. And to be frank with this one, the market was very happy with this report, Steve. So revenue came in at $910 million. That was up 14% year-on-year, beating expectations. A fun fact about this, Steve, about 6 years ago, that was all they did in revenue a year, about $907 million. So now they do that a quarter. Pretty interesting. EPS was 71 cents. That was up only 700% year-on-year. So they must have had a bit of a dodgy quarter last year. That means that op income was also up 423% to $152 million. Op margin is a bit wild when you look at it, but it's about 15% at the moment, but it's been way higher and way lower, which makes me think it may have some of that monthly / annual kind of sort of elasticity to their op margin that Autodesk has. Customer spending over 1 million, Steve, is up 15% as well. That's up to 834 customers, which is quite a lot when you think about it. Total ARR was 3.858. That was up 16% year over year. Cloud revenue was growing at 29% to 445 million. GAAP op expenses, Steve, declined 2% year over year. Non-GAAP op expenses declined 3% year over year. So this is a company screwing down on costs for you, which is what you want to see in the cybersecurity industry. You want to see a bit of maturity in the industry. Well, Splunk are definitely showing it. Trailing 12-month op cash flow, Steve, $827 million. That was up just 247% year over year. And trailing 12-month free cash flow was $805 million, up 273% year on year. So I have listened to the earnings call, and I pulled a couple of things out. This is Gary Steele. He's the president and CEO of Splunk, and he's got an incredible name.
Good name, that. Yeah,
it is a good name. Splunk delivered another solid quarter, demonstrating the incredible value organizations worldwide gain from unified security and observability. Through our ongoing focus on accelerating innovation and harnessing AI, we unveiled many important advancements during the quarter to help customers strengthen their overall digital resilience and security posture. Our team's strong execution, operational discipline, and deep customer engagement have again illustrated Splunk's leadership. Talk about talking your own book, Steve. He said, this was CFO Brian Roberts. Q2 represents a strong quarter of growth, execution, and operating leverage. We generated 16% ARR growth as we reduced our non-GAAP op expenses by 3% year over year. We are raising our full-year outlook on the top and bottom line as we focus on driving growth by delivering value to our customers and increasing profitability through greater efficiencies. The market, Steve, sent this one 18% higher on the week, but it's still not trading at a valuation that's particularly obscene to me, Steve. What do you think about it?
30-ish times forward earnings? No, it's not crazy. This is a much smaller company than NVIDIA, although it's not obvious it plays in a massively smaller pool here, right? It's got companies all around the world, 834 spend more than a million. tell me about the company that's not interested in their digital posturing, and I'll find you a company that's full of liars. But this is the kind of company that you find more, that you more typically find these kind of growth numbers from, right? These are huge stuff, and that will come down pretty fast, these kind of PE numbers, if they can keep going just for a little bit, right? I mean, 30 chips away quite quickly if you can get another, whatever you said, 400 and something percent growth coming out in each year again. The OPEX coming down is also good to see. They talked about operating leverage, which is encouraging as well. Obviously, that was the man called Brian, not the man called Gary Steele, making these boring comments about ARR and operating leverage. Gary Steele, much too busy talking about observability and digital posturing.
Yeah, and they're the sort of words you would expect from somebody called Gary Steele, wouldn't you? He sounds like a strong man.
He does sound like a strong man. He sounds like a man who's had an uphill paper round.
Yeah. One of the things I picked out, Steve, which was quite interesting to me, was stock-based comp has been one of those runaway things for Splunk. It's been increasing fairly rapidly. I mean, I'm looking at 2019, it was 442 million, 545, 619, 795. So you're thinking that's probably a little bit of a worry. However, last year, Steve, it actually fell. And it only fell by 6 million, Steve. But when you think about the growth rates, we were essentially adding around 100 million extra stock-based compensation every year. For it to fall 6 million just makes me start to think that this company is beginning to think about its shareholders a little bit more than being, you know, being essentially a company run for its employees. So that's just something to keep an eye on. I actually think this looks like a pretty decent company, Steve. I'm not entirely sure if I would buy it over something like Fortinet, which is the one that I think is the better of the bunch. Well, Palo Alto would be the best of the bunch if you could get it a valuation that was a little bit more palatable. But it looks fine to me, Steve. Anything?
Yeah, Palo Alto did all right in their kind of earnings, really, didn't they, recently, which I guess is what good companies do in a lot of ways, or at least well-run companies in a certain kind of way tend to do this.
Yeah, that was the Friday evening report where everybody was thinking, after seeing Fortinet's report of slowing growth, they were thinking, oh, this is going to be a disaster. Nobody does a Friday evening report if they've got something good to tell you because the market's closed and they get no reaction. And Palo Alto just, I mean, they've done something they'll never do again. They just innocently came up with this basically investor presentation that they've been working on, slides and video and everything that they just obviously needed a little bit of extra time to put together. It was basically more like an investor day rather than an earnings presentation. But yeah, because the market crapped itself all like week and a half beforehand and sent their shares much lower, they essentially regained it all back after the earnings report, and everyone realized that this was just a bit of clumsy calendar work rather than than an actual problem.
With Splunk, I sort of wonder whether, I don't think it quite does, but Peter Lynch says look for companies that have stupid names, right? Because other people can't buy them, because you can't be a hedge fund and say, guys, I've just bought 2,000 shares of Splunk, no, with an L. Your hedge fund manager says, get out of my fucking office and don't come back. And sometimes he reckons you find bargains like this and things that have stupid names. I'm not sure Splunk is quite there, because I sort of think in this space, things call themselves whatever they like, to be honest, and they mostly get away with it because there's a general sense that there's kind of tech expertise hiding behind this, and you don't argue with the techie nerds because they know what they're doing. So I don't know. You think that's there, Steve? You think this might be kind of a bargain because of its name?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's one of those dangerous things if we were to do because we're basically broadcasting this electronically, Steve. Obviously, Steve is not sat in the next room from me, and we don't have a wire connection. Steve is quite a way away, so this is all broadcast over the internet. And we are prone to the odd fallout in voice and things like that, or dropped letters. So this could be very, very, very bad for us, Steve, if we were to say that, one of us had bought a handful of Splunk.
Yeah, silent L, of course, in Splunk. But anyway, that's pretty much it for our show. We'll leave you with those thoughts about handfuls of Splunk. If you've been pumping this one, then let us know recently downstairs in the comments. We will see you next week. Thank you very much for listening. More from us in a week's time. Bye for now.